is required. We are a long, long way from Picasso and Matisse, and we are a long way from where the first registrars to set standards Dorothy Dudley and Irma Wilkinson began. Looking out over our current landscape, institutions of various types are collecting performance, multimedia installations, and large-scale sculptural installations, as well as that use a myriad of elements such as running water, atypical materials, sound, light, moving image, all types of technology and mechanics. Some are even putting restaurants in your galleries. Did you hear what I said? They're putting food in your galleries. You should be very upset about this. Okay? How do you store such works? How do we catalog all the components of an artwork? Are they essential? Are they reusable, replaceable? What can be refabricated? And in addition to the physical and technological longevity that we are facing with works, how should we document a new version of a work? Take note. This is when we first acquired the work, and this was an installation in the Venice Biennale. All of this is to remind you that the impractical nature of contemporary art requires flexibility and problem solving from all of the stakeholders. And I like the word that someone else used earlier, allies. We are all allies in this together. But registrars and collection managers, together with non-curatorial staff, are on the front lines of implementing care for contemporary art. And our participation in the capital T for team effort it takes to manage the variable and unpredictable mediums of installation, performance, and large-scale sculpture is absolutely essential. So please, don't back away from this. This is where our future is. The great secret about this is that we don't even need to reinvent the wheel. The standard for documenting and managing collections continues to be relevant. Our standard, the registrar standard, is 57 years old, and the most recent edition was updated in 2010 with new sections to address contemporary art. So when we move forward, we should remember to look back because many of the methods that guide us toward the future already exist. At the Museum of Modern Art, we have the opportunity to explore the challenges of contemporary art collection management as part of our acquisition, loan, and exhibition programs. All the slides that we'll be showing you today are works from our permanent collection. We don't have the answers. We're not up here to tell you how to do it. We are simply here to share our experiences and the particular circumstances we have encountered to give you a peek into the challenges that we have faced with contemporary art at MoMA. And if you leave with just one takeaway, our mantras are, the situation is never the same twice. Nothing is ever, ever simple. And money, no matter how much you have, will solve all your problems. Let's take a deep breath and jump in, don't we? We're going to speak in different sections, so I'm going to speak right now about performance in the museum. Caring for contemporary art is especially challenging when dealing with artwork that is performance-based. Performance as a medium is inherently transient, subject to change, and arguably as impossible to replicate as a paint stroke. Maybe, maybe not. MoMA, and I'm going to refer to the museum as MoMA because that's most comfortable for me, established the Department of Media and Performance Art in 2008. Since then, we have acquired the work of about 10 artists in our collection that we actually classify as performance. And this artwork is a mix of scores, object props, and historical documents. If you have ever had the experience of engaging with such work, you will actually never forget it. Performance is a shapeshifter. There is rarely any solid ground, and the very act of documenting it is our way of preserving it. This effort to document requires a great deal of follow-through on our part and the participation of various voices not frequently invited into the process. This task is not without its problems when our endeavors to identify fundamental qualities of the artwork requires us to negotiate information, which is usually controlled by curatorial staff, and time, which is generally dictated by the exhibition schedules we have. The volume of detail needed to get it right is simply impossible to extract in a single intervention with an artwork or even with a single meeting with an artist. The principal concerns of artist intent, physical context, and future transformation tend to be treated as supplemental, but in fact, they are the equivalent of importance to descriptive data like an artist's name, title, date, medium, and dimension. But this information doesn't exist on a label. Instead, it is embedded in artist interviews, questionnaires, photo documentation, as well as film and video recordings of previous iterations. To draw out the details from these sources requires time that we really just don't have. Still, even in a small amount of information can illuminate the subtle importance of the interaction between attendants and visitors in Roman Ondak's Measuring the Universe. The visitors enter the gallery and are measured in an orderly and methodological manner by first name and date over the course of the installation, which incrementally reveals a linear mark composed by thousands of participants. We can also, with this information, identify the various ways in which a performable object, such as a prepared piano in a Lauren Calzadilla's Stop Repair Prepare, is used and destroyed over time. Performers don't simply play Ode to Joy backwards and upside down on the piano with a hole that is cut in the middle of its musical body, but they also push this piano on the casters through the space, expressively plucking the strings and banging the hammers with their hands. Now, how such wear and tear impacts the structural life and the sonic life of the piano contributes to the decisions that we will make about its care. While there is abundant detail to be maintained, knowing what to ask is essential. Over time, the kinds of useful questions we needed to ask developed into an 8-page performance worksheet. I said 8 pages. All this information was pulling together the details from various stakeholders, and it provided frequently overlooked but useful details ranging from location design to HR-related concerns for the non-staff individuals that might be performing on our premises. But 8 pages is a lot. Now, can you imagine trying to obtain all this information and executing the actual performance with the already busy schedules that we have? Managing these instructions for the purpose of installation was so time-consuming that it deserved its own position. So at MoMA, we created the role of performance producer to liaise with the staff and facilitate the administration of our live performances. This person also exists as a conduit for additional input and feedback from various stakeholders in the information gathering process. Not every institution is regularly mounting performances in their galleries, but we all have the potential to do this because many of our collections have objects with performative characteristics. They tend to be object-like props cataloged as relics from a past action or that are preserved in a dormant state, but they can even be an archive of instructions, like here, and photographs, which is Milan Knežak performance files. And this material is basically a grouping of performances that are examples of works that this Eastern European artist did in the 60s. And we have this currently on view in our museum. When we identify the performed state of our documentation, our documentation efforts must take into account that another form of display and understanding will be revealed, which captures the object's potential for variability. Let's talk about that concept a little bit. This is James Lee Byers, an example of James Lee Byers' work. He was a performance artist whose actions, objects, books, and ephemera express a preoccupation with the fleeting quality of beauty and perfection in the world. Byers had a long relationship with the MoMA curator Dorothy C. Miller in the 1960s, and that relationship is documented through a collection of correspondence that is held in our museum archives. These are samples of the correspondence. And we have letters and invitation cards, exhibition proposals, all statements expressing his ideas about projects he wished to realize in the museum. The thoughtful dialogue that the two of them had resulted in a donation by the artist in 1966 of three performable paper works. Thank you. Mile-long paper walk is one of the works, and it is a stack of 74 white rectangular paper sheets with rounded ends that are connected piece by piece with rivets that unfurl like a mechanical ruler. Since the paper stack was accepted into the collection, it had been displayed only as an object prop, and our overall perspective had always been its preservation in this state. Its potential for the performance aspect of it had never been realized, and our existing documentation was quite limited to a photograph and a note from the artist. This photograph, which is actually pretty common on the internet, you can find this as well. It was in our Department of Drawing and Prints artist files, because this object actually lives in our paper department. The note to the side is the artist's description referring to the artwork, and the photograph is our only known example of the objects used prior to our re-performance at MoMA in 2013. It depicts the dancer, Lucinda Childs, in a white feather costume in the Hall of Sculpture at the Carnegie Museum of Art in 1965. I want to just highlight right here that this is a general description that the artist gave for the work. And as you can see, he says that you may put this out as a halo, as a star, as a perimeter, or performed however. So this gives you a lot of room here, right? In order to consider activating this work, there were two concerns. Using an irreplaceable, fragile object prop was not an option, so an exhibition copy was fabricated. The process of this replication for the purpose of performance allowed us to incorporate new data detailing the material type, the process of making, and the cost by which we could use for future exhibition planning. The second concern was documenting the re-performance in order to add to and expand to the existing museum record. We relied heavily on Ms. Child's memory from the initial event, and now we needed to archive those memories for the future. We also had photos and video of the performance, and we had the input of the performance producer who accumulated the details, such as the performers that we used, the location specifications, costume types, and the duration. Now, moving from the historical to present-day artworks generally means that the artist is present. But having the artist present doesn't really make our effort to document artwork any easier. Our thoughts as museum professionals, you all get the joke, I know. Our thoughts as museum professionals are geared toward an unknown future presentation, when in fact the artist's mind is almost always in the present, refining, retuning, and reassessing their work. The key to establishing artist intent, physical context, and the knowledge necessary for future interpretation is establishing a rapport around the artwork's elements of variability. This is Paul Chan's Waiting for Godot, which entered the museum's permanent collection in 2008. This slide is an image of its installation in our galleries 2 years after its acquisition. when the artwork arrived, it was still an archive, and it was comprised of over 240 documents, objects, and ephemera that were all related to Mr. Chan's effort. The project was created for Creative Time in collaboration with the Classical Theater in Harlem and several New Orleans-based partners in 2007. Those partners included the University of New Orleans, Xavier University, Dillard University, several high schools, and community organizations, just to give you a sense of how deeply he embedded himself in the community here. Mr. Chan's activity culminated in the production of four free outdoor evening performances of the Samuel Beckett play, Waiting for Godot. And this took place in the Lower Ninth Ward and in the Gentilly quarters of New Orleans, which are, I think, if I read my map correctly, are north and east of where we are right now. The performances were in response to the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. The archive itself is a physical representation of the artist's footprint of activity over the several months-long project here. The items accumulated included location photos, street signs, notes from community classes he taught, all of which wove a social perspective into his engagement with the city. There were lists of residential contacts, maps, and location notes, pencil drawings of his stage set concepts and performance production notes, as well as props and a snippet of video from one of the live performances. When we acquired the archive, the artist had not fully resolved how he imagined this material existing in the museum collection, let alone how it would be displayed. It was clear that he understood its placement in the museum collection would leave it less accessible than a library setting, which possibly ensured its dual reality as a surrogate for his community-based performance action and its existence as a historical document. I want to just highlight that because this is an unusual place with archives and museums, that they can act as an object and they can also exist as documentation, like real documentation that you keep in libraries. And this is sort of a new thing that is happening. Upon acquisition, we had received Paul Chan's stored boxes of material, but it was lacking any order. The artist had never fully reviewed the elements to establish what could be used for exhibition. And in our first installation of this work in the museum in 2010, the artist was present to select the components for display. In order to give a sense of the ephemeral nature of the work, as well as to protect what was personal information, we made color scans of the most fragile paper-based works selected for exhibition in order to create templates. The copies were made from these scans of the actual document, and some included blackened areas to obscure private information. These sheets were then used to create the exhibition copies for the document-based elements on view. That's just one example of the many things we did with this work, but I don't really have time to go into it in detail. But I'm going to leave you with a couple of questions. Is it possible that the artist may choose to add or subtract from the 240 elements that comprise the archive? Perhaps. And what about the inevitable deterioration of the props? Is it really realistic for us to think that we do have a true understanding of this artwork's potential and meaning after one intense engagement? In my opinion, this is the beginning of a long follow-up that involves many conversations with the artist and various stakeholders in its care. New situations will be new opportunities to capture a formerly hidden or underdeveloped aspect of the contemporary. And these points of information gathering are what my colleague, Brandy Pomfret, will discuss next.
Thanks. I want to make sure I'm on. That's what I sound like on a microphone, apparently. So all the registrars here in this room are well-versed in a wide range of art, different types and different periods in history. But at Sydney, as shown, we at the Museum of Modern Art focus mostly on modern and contemporary and spend much of our time these days balancing our needs as an institution and the needs of the artwork that we're handling. And with a hearty acquisition program, we're constantly being challenged to adapt. In the past, we as registrars have seen our fair share of what we considered complicated works, and over the years have developed a sort of autopilot response for dealing with them. When faced with oversized works, we're used to saying, can it fit through a doorway? Can it fit in my elevator? And exceedingly heavy works are questioned for floor stability and if you need to hire an outside rigging company. But the main question now that we're faced with is what happens when art evolves? This is Robert Gober's Untitled, and it was conceived in 2001 and relates to the time between the September 11th attacks and the Bush and Kerry elections, with references to life and death, birth and rebirth, and religion and politics. It was acquired by MoMA in 2005, directly from the gallery where it premiered, and as you can see here, looks fairly unassuming. Nothing any of us would probably have any problem installing. There's some bases, there's some sculptures, framed works on walls, not a big deal. But there are a number of you here who are familiar with Gober's works, and you're used to seeing fruits cast from wax, paint cans made out of glass. Everything he makes is out of unconventional materials to make you question what you know about art. Nothing is clear-cut with Gober, so it's no surprise, then, that when works like this show up on a checklist, it's an even more of a reminder how important we as registrars are, because upon review of notes and documentation taken by those registrars who've come before us, you begin to see how the two doors in the rear are cracked open just enough to reveal sculpted wax legs in tubs of constant running water, or how the simple-looking Christ figure in the center of the installation is projecting water seemingly from out of nowhere through his nipples and into a hole jackhammered through the floor of the museum, which, yes, we did. In this instance, as well as with many works made in the last few decades, we're no longer responsible for putting these individual sculptures into a gallery, but crafting a room that's just as important to the installation as the components are themselves. The two tub rooms have to be constructed to a specific size for the artist's intention, as well as having a functional space for all of our behind-the-scenes needs. In a large contemporary installation such as this, curators see the standard checklist image, and people like us see extremely specific positioning of lighting components, and water level markers, and pumps and filters hidden in the walls. A single piece like this one untitled work requires a multitude of people working in concert, from registrars and plumbers to engineers and the artist's studio. There isn't a start or an end, but a group of people all working together with a single purpose. Installations like these raise a whole new set of challenges for the registrar. Some of them, like how do you break through the floor of your museum, or how do you run water 24/7 for 4 months, are a little easier to navigate and process during the initial stage of exhibition planning. Sometimes you don't know how a visitor will react to an active stream of water, or how adjacent works will be affected until the piece is actually installed. And even worse, sometimes you think you know how a work will act, and despite all your best planning efforts, you realize that some things just can't be foreseen. So let's start from the beginning. What happens when a work like this is being acquired? As I mentioned, we acquired this directly from its first showing in a gallery. We actually received some installation notes, which, as many of you know, is quite shocking, and discussed how the artist-made doors are bonded to the walls during display and thus have to be chiseled out at the end of the showing. And already after this one showing, the wood was cracking so badly at the joints from stress, they had to be returned to the artist's studio before they could even make it to the museum. Here they added metal bars to the frame and behind the door, as well as crating it again, so that it could be stabilized for shipment and for future installations. After a one-month showing in a gallery, the water was also having some issues with algae growth, and in a preemptive measure, the studio also took back their faucet to reconstruct them with plastic piping rather than metal. Which leads us to 2007. We received a request to loan the work to the Schallager in Basel, Switzerland. We reviewed all of our files, and it seemed to say the problems we saw during our acquisition 2 years prior had been addressed and solved, but we didn't have installation instructions. So this was a perfect chance for us to send someone to oversee the installation, document it all from start to finish. But unfortunately, as we're learning more and more, you can plan for some things, but you can't plan for all things. because using the exact instructions and equipment we were provided at acquisition, as well as the studio's help in Basel, this is how our legs looked after draining the water from the tubs. Yeah. What hadn't occurred in the one-month installation in New York, and thus we couldn't foresee, was a reaction between copper fittings in the tubes and distilled water that was used in Basel. Upon return to New York, all the plumbing was replaced with plastic fittings, and all the notes and instructions were updated with all the dates and changes we made to the work. We hadn't eradicated the problems, but we learned an immense amount, and we were getting a little closer. Use this as a great opportunity to add to our knowledge base, if nothing else. So fast forward to 2014, and a Robert Gober retrospective at our own institution. We'd only loaned the portion consisting of the tub rooms prior to this, and now wanted to show the installation in its entirety for the first time since it became part of the collection 9 years prior, and we were now back at square one. We were in our own institution, though, so we were determined to find a balance between what we know to be integral to his vision of the installation as a whole and how to care for and exhibit it for the future. As I mentioned before, the problems inherent to exhibiting the work, like drilling through the floor and running water, we knew we could handle with proper planning and teamwork across our institution. I mean, it wasn't easy by any stretch, but come on, what red star doesn't love a challenge, really? And luckily, we had a living artist who has said before that one of his favorite activities is to meet with conservators and registrars to resolve the challenges of the unorthodox materials he so often uses. It was our chance to not only update our records, but to also update the installation with new technologies for those components he felt were open to change in order to protect the work from further damage. A metal screen has to be inserted into the Christ hole during exhibition to create a muffled sound that is required by the artist. Though the sound is very important to him, the material itself is not. So when the screen had started to rust, causing the water to discolor and algae to build up and start seeping from Christ's nipples, and trust me, you don't want to see that picture. it wasn't pretty. A new stainless steel screen was inserted for a successful run of the show. We also changed the lights to LED instead of the original halogen to reduce the buildup of heat and humidity in the small tub rooms. New UV filters were added to the tub's pumps, and silver powder was put into the water to slow, if not completely stem, the growth of algae we were expecting to see after a four-month run. Additionally, each week, our art handlers would stir the water to disrupt the algae and change all the filters. And yet, at the close of our exhibit, we were faced with this. The change from copper fittings to plastic helped keep our legs from turning green, but algae and mold were still found to be adhered to the sculptures. The male legs also had such exaggerated hair loss caused by a flow of water created by a pump that is in that specific tub. We couldn't see the damage that was occurring to the component while it was installed, so the piece wasn't adjusted to lessen the effects until it was too late. All the losses, which is what you can see here, had to be marked with acupuncture needles. Yeah, and all new hairs inserted one by one by our conservation team before the sculptures could be packed and joined the rest of the work in storage. And despite our efforts to reduce heat and humidity in the rooms, we were left with newspapers so cockled and warped they were rendered completely unusable in the future. Upon recommendations from the artists, we had tested fusing the papers with sheets of aluminum, but we learned without a proper ventilation system, it'll still be an inevitable and unavoidable occurrence. And for us, Gober is just the beginning, because this is Josh Klein's Skittles, which MoMA just acquired this year, about 4 months ago, after it was created for display on the High Line in New York City. The piece consists of a commercial refrigerator, similar to those found in any New York deli, but inside the locked fridge, instead of smoothies found in a high-end juice bar, he has bottled 15 different flavors of a range of organic, inorganic, and highly unconventional ingredients. When grouped together, they're supposed to evoke a landscape of aspiration, taste, and, at times, deprivation in a city like New York City. And though they can't be sampled, the ingredients are printed on the sides for all to see. So one titled Big Data includes items like Purell, Google Glass, Verizon Bill, porn. Tourism has Starbucks coffee, hotel soap, a New York Metro card. And crowd control contains pig's blood, a video camera, and pepper spray. Like with our Gober work, we are again faced with a large sculptural installation that will require the involvement of many departments inside and out of the museum and will ultimately be affected by time. With the Gober installation, the lights could be updated with the latest technology, but what about the lights of this work? Who tends to and repairs the structure? Conservation or electricians? What about a fridge repairman? We were able to add chemicals to the water in the Gober bathtubs to try and stop bacteria growth. But what about these mixtures? How essential is the exact ingredients list in his eyes, and would there be a detrimental effect on the work caused by conservation intervention? How long can these last in an exhibit inside a museum? How about outside in a museum, like a sculpture garden? As a response to our many questions, the artist provided us with a 7-page list of ingredients he feels are prone to obsolescence and what items can or cannot be switched out in the future. Certain things like medical scrubs that are a specific color and type can be purchased and held on to, but what of self-tanner lotion? It would seem foreign currency is a fairly loose and safe term to include in bottle service until you realize they must be quote-unquote global oligarchs buying up New York real estate. And if we try and stockpile these ingredients now, how do we safely store them so that they don't expire at the same rate of the ingredients as if they were on view? We've gone through 2 sets of newspapers with our Gober per showing. Despite our best efforts, we'll seemingly continue to do so. Following our retrospective, we were given 5 by the artist, but what happens when we've used all those and then the artist passes? Contemporary installations like this Gober and the Klein serve as a reminder that we registrars are evolving and transitioning from simply documenting how to install a work and inventorying components to noting what components can be changed in the future without changing the intent of the work, what happened at specific moments in time, and what will happen no matter how much we plan. Questions to plan for the future are going to continue to arise. What materials will expire? What will cease to exist when the time comes to show this? What is integral to the artist's vision of the work, and what is mutable? With all the added complications contemporary art is beginning to present to us, the registrars who come long after us are going to have to rely more and more on the documentation we're creating now than we've ever had to with works that came before us. We're responsible not just to the artwork, but to those registrars and collection managers and specialists who follow behind us. We'll most likely never probably get a grasp on contemporary art as it continues to change, but as Ellen will hopefully show you, we can get a little bit closer each day.
Thank you, Brandy.
So Dan and I will be talking about Saigo Chang and a recent large-scale installation of a 100-year-old boat at MoMA. Here are some things you should know about Sai. He was born in 1957 in China. He's well known for his gunpowder paintings, his large-scale exploding installations, and his firework display for both the opening and closing ceremonies of the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. And most notably, he lives and works in New York, so he's going to show up with his translator and tell you how he feels if you're installing a piece of artwork in the area. So you better invite him into the process early. Borrowing Your Enemy's Arrows was acquired at MoMA in 1999 and was only shown in 2000 in MoMA's old building prior to the 2004 expansion. So when we started to budget and plan the logistics for this installation for the exhibition, Scenes for a New Heritage, currently up at MoMA through April 2016, we went to the master files, and this is what we found. What registrar isn't happy to go into the file room and find a giant binder with Polaroid pictures, handwritten lists, and typed instructions? This would be okay if this was 1999, but we can do a little better now. With each new collection installation, it's the registrar's opportunity and responsibility to clean up the record, update the installation notes, and hopefully make the whole process more streamlined and efficient for future registrars. So the goal is to capture all the necessary information, such as cost to install, crate dimensions, components, installation notes, and photographs in the TMS record, so that when the installation is replicated at other institutions, it can be replicated to the lending institution standards. This screen contains all the components of an object, including the crates with dimensions. In 2008, for an outgoing loan to the Saigo Chang retrospective, going to the Guggenheim and then on to China as the second venue, we asked BoxArt to design and build crates for this work. that would not only allow the 100-year-old boat to travel safely internationally and domestically, but to also assist in the installation and rigging of the piece. The crate was also designed for long-term storage and preservation of the object. So with that, please allow me to introduce Dan Hanford, Director of Box Art, to talk more in detail about these complicated crates.
This is Win Box. When Box Art was asked to create this work of art, we were very excited about such a unique project. It wasn't until we actually had to sit down and design the crates that the real fear and panic set in, very much like his presentation. As most everyone in this room knows, for an outgoing loan such as this, there are many parties involved and multiple factors that ultimately influence the design process. On the lender side, we had the conservator's preservation-minded specifications and the registrar's installation and handling requirements. On the shipper side, we had their dimensional restrictions for transport and shipping to China. And finally, on the borrower side, they, of course, have their own set of dimensional restrictions for getting the artwork in the building, as well as discretion over the timeline and the budget. As you can well imagine, protecting the art while also satisfying the requirements of all the previously mentioned parties can be a challenging task. To complete this project successfully, there is going to have to be an open and flexible dialogue with all parties involved, as well as some new and innovative approaches to some very old and traditional problems. The Saigo Chang piece, Barring Your Enemy's Arrows, consists of two main parts. One, 1,500-pound, very old, fragile boat. As Ellen mentioned previously, MoMA's conservators were worried about the long-term damage that might occur if the actual boat had to be taken apart each time it was shipped. The second part, of course, is the 1,800 arrows. Even though the conservators would not let the actual boat be taken apart, thankfully they were okay with removing and packing the arrows separately. To install the piece, the riggers lift the boat up into position and hang it. Then the art handlers go up on scissor lifts and insert the arrows one by one by hand into the sides. Installing these arrows is such a labor-intensive task, the registrars wanted the packing and unpacking of the crates to be as time and labor-efficient as possible. The traditional approach for packing the 1,800 arrows would be to ride them flat in some kind of tray system. If we alternated the trays, we could maybe put 20 arrows on a foam core tray, and the trays are super lightweight, so we could safely stack 10 trays on top of each other in each crate. So that would give us 200 arrows in each crate, and it would take a total of 9 crates to contain all the 1,800 arrows. Good, right? Everybody's happy. Well, not everybody. Although this tray system is perfectly fine for packing and shipping these arrows safely, it doesn't really address the many concerns of the other stakeholders in this process. For example, for the MoMA registrars, packing this number of crates is going to be a very time and labor-intensive process on what already is a time and labor-intensive process. Also for the borrower, 9 crates with 90 trays just for the arrows? No, that's going to be quite expensive for what already is a high-budget exhibition. But perhaps most importantly, this tray system does not properly address on how to help the art handler when it's time to go up on the lifts and insert the arrows into the boat. For installation using this tray system, you'd have to bring the trays up on the lift, and you're not going to be able to get more than one or two trays on the lift safely. And even then, the footprint of the trays are so large, it's not going to leave enough space for the art handler to move around in the basket of the lift. These 9 crates with all these trays, this is not going to work. We have to design a more efficient system. We need to help the art handlers get the arrows out of the crates, up on the lifts, and into the boat with relative ease. It seemed obvious that further thinking needed to be done, and so we thought, well, hey, how do people normally travel arrows? Yes. Let's make some quiver-like container. Something that could hold multiple arrows. Something that would allow the art handler to carry numerous arrows in one hand and insert them into the boat with the other. But it's got to be easy to use and simple and affordable to make. So after many hours of intense design and prototyping, we came up with this complex structure. We drilled 25 holes in a 6x6 piece of ethylene. And now we had our quivers. For installation, racks were constructed to hold several quivers, and multiple racks could be brought up on the lift at one time. In the crates, the cribbers hang on shelves and are held down with traditional track braces. So that's 25 arrows in each quiver, and we were able to get 36 quivers in each crate for a total of 2 crates with 900 arrows in each, much better than the original 9 crates that the tray system required. This, of course, is going to bring down the crating and shipping costs, which should please the borrower, but it's the art handlers who are going to be very happy, because now they can take two or three racks up on a lift at a time, and then take each individual quiver out of the rack and hold a loaded quiver in one hand and place the arrows into the boat with the other. Overall, this quiver and rack system proved to be a safe, less expensive, and much more functional alternative to the traditional tray system. Plus, we got to make quivers out of foam. That was very cool. For creating the boat in one piece, we had a whole different set of challenges. We wanted the bottom of the crate to act like an installation tray, so the riggers could lift the tray up into position for hanging without ever touching the boat directly. This meant that the walls and the roof of the crate would have to be removable. The crate was going to be so large and heavy, we felt it was better to separate the structural framework from the exterior plywood skin. This design would allow it to be assembled and disassembled by hand, and no additional machinery would be required. It's kind of like how you would build a house. Like, the crate walls were framed out with timber, and then fastened together and mounted to the bottom of the crate with bolts so they could be removed and reused. For the roof of the crate, we hung several 2x12 joists across the top to create the roof support, and those joists also acted like track braces to hold the boat down securely. Once all the framework and joists were assembled and the piece was secured, the framework was sealed in plastic, and finally, the plywood skin was attached all around in overlapping sections to act as walls. It's just like a house. For the crate to be structural at this size and weight, the total wall thickness with the framework and siding needed to be at least 4 inches thick. The piece was 98 inches wide. With 1 inch of space around it, plus the 4 inches of wall thickness on each side, the crate was going to be 108 inches in total. Unfortunately, that was a problem, because for shipping to China, the crate could be no larger than 102 inches wide. So this crate design as is was not going to work. It was 6 inches too wide. Again, we had to stop and really go back to the drawing board and find a new solution for getting the width of this crate down under 102. So let's look at the boat again. It's 98 inches wide, and we need it to be 6 inches smaller or 92 inches wide for the crate to fit under the width restriction. But it's really only 98 inches wide in those two center sections. And even at 98 inches, the boat is smaller than the overall width restriction. So we went back to the crate design. If we could somehow get rid of that framework on each side of the crate, then the boat will fit. Unfortunately, we need that framework for the crate to be structural. But the boat is oversized in those center sections only. What if we built the framework around the oversized sections? And that's when we decided to design some windows into the framework. We redesigned the crate to allow for 2 24x96 inch windows, one on each side of the framework. These windows allowed the oversized sections of the boat to protrude into the framework, but were small enough not to impact the overall structure of the crate. These windows allowed us to actually build the crate as if the piece was 92 inches wide and not 98. So the interior of this crate is actually 6 inches smaller than the width of the artwork. Once we figured out the windows, we were able to get the crate down under the size restriction, and it was ready to ship. Everyone was happy. Well, at least happier. I want to close by saying that handling contemporary art is, at its core, a collaborative effort. Everyone must have a voice, but the key is to bring all those opinions together to create a safe and efficient solution. No idea is too silly or outrageous not to consider. Whether it be Ethicon quivers or windows and crates, it's often in these extreme considerations that a real solution can be found. Still, no easy task to get this crate up onto the second floor at MoMA and install it, and Ellen's going to tell you how that whole thing worked.
Okay. Me again. I'll go fast.
So this installation at MoMA would be the first time exhibiting the boat since it returned from loan to China in 2008 and the crate was created. The original artist installation note said that the boat may come apart into three pieces to enable it to get into a space, but this had never been done before since the artist shipped it to the U.S. from China and assembled it here. MoMA's sculpture conservators did not feel comfortable taking the 100-year-old boat apart, as it would be time-consuming, labor-intensive, and risk doing irreparable damage to the piece. Therefore, when the crate was designed, the crate and tray were made to accommodate the entire boat as a whole. It is estimated that the boat weighs 1,500 pounds and the crate weighs about the same. Several options of getting the sculpture into the building were considered, but conservation deemed the only safe option was to rig the work crated through MoMA's roll-up garage door directly onto the second-floor contemporary space. Once it was decided how we were going to get the crate into the building and a date was scheduled, a high-tech template for placement was designed by our production team. So on Saturday, January 31st, with Sunday, February 1st being our planned snow day, or just an extra day if we needed it, just as an aside, Sunday, February 1st was Super Bowl Sunday, and our riggers really didn't want to work on Super Bowl Sunday. The crate was transported on a flatbed truck from Budco Storage on Long Island at 6 a.m. The crate was constructed to handle this sort of transit and climate even in January, and it was cold. Permits were in place to shut down 54th Street from 5th to 6th Avenue for the entire weekend. Lucky for us and the riggers, we only had to close the street on Saturday morning. Permission for access had to be granted from the neighboring construction site of the new Nouvelle building going up beside MoMA. They kindly complied but would not allow us to pull the truck or crane into the construction site. This 3,000-pound crate would need to be swung in from 54th Street. The MoMA garage door that was used for the Richard Serra exhibition was conceived to accommodate large-scale contemporary objects that are too large to fit into the dock and freight elevator. The door was put in place during MoMA's last building expansion in 2004 and will be moved to the 54th Street side once the Nouvelle building goes up and there's no access to this side of the building anymore. This was the first time since the Serra exhibition in 2007 that the roll-up door was needed. Lucky for us, it still worked. As you can imagine, the climate in February was not ideal to open a giant hole in the gallery space. So therefore, the boat was the first object in the space even before the walls were finished being constructed. Also, we needed wide open spaces to get this monster in. This area is referred to as the buffer zone. So the door doesn't open directly into the gallery space. There's another wall between the outside wall and the galleries. The crate is lowered onto dollies and rolled into the gallery space. As you can see, the opening in the gallery was cut just wide enough to accommodate the crate. In the data system, we've added the step-by-step unpacking photos as the crate is complicated and unusual, and as Dan discussed, the crate comes completely apart to reveal the boat and to allow for rigging on the tray. Here's the skeleton with the outer panels removed. Uncrating may take up to an hour and a half to completely reveal the boat. Here's a good view of the windows that Dan mentioned before. As the wood of the boat ages, it becomes more dry and brittle, thus making the possibility of taking it apart even more risky. Of course, before bringing it into the museum, and because it had not been uncrated and viewed since returning from China in 2008, conservation, registration, and exhibition production made a field trip out to storage on Long Island. There we uncrated the object, made notes, took measurements and photographs, and conservation took samples and tested them for any infestation prior to bringing it in. The walls of the crate are completely taken off, and as Dan has shown, here's a good shot of how the object is cradled on the tray. All the elements packed inside the cavity of the boat, the mast, the oars are unpacked. And as I mentioned before, the temperature in the gallery that morning was very cold because of the opening to the outside. So here we see our art handlers and our riggers wearing hats and jackets to keep them warm, but alas, no gloves. The tray is rolled into place and the cables are strung through the eye bolts on the side and underneath the boat. For stability and safety, the boat still on the tray is lifted into into place with hand-cranked gantries. Cables that are attached to an I-beam in the ceiling are tightened and secured only when the boat reaches the correct height of 13 feet. The total ceiling height in the contemporary galleries at MoMA is 21 feet. We all know what this is, right? Break time. And then the tray is slowly lowered and removed. And finally, our boat flies through the air. The same installation was done at the MFA in Houston in 2003 and the Guggenheim in 2008. This is a slide of the Guggenheim installation. The boat was raised in the Frank Lloyd Wright Rotunda with a system of scaffolds. This was prior to the crate being constructed, and as we see, to a much higher height than at MoMA. Of course, each building has its own unique set of issues and logistics to contend with, but every time you install it, you learn a little more, the object record becomes a little better, and hopefully the entire process becomes a little more streamlined and easier for everyone the next time. Our Guggenheim colleagues provided us with a wealth of information from their 2008 installation. On to the arrows. As Dan mentioned, some 1,800 arrows are inserted by our art handlers using cold wax, and the process is labor-intensive and takes about 3 days with four art handlers on lifts. So this single object takes a great deal of time, resources, and budget. Finally, all done. Afterwards, the boat had to be tended so the gallery walls could be finished. The walls were built around this installation, and as I mentioned, it had to be the first object in and the last object out, as the walls have to be demolished to get it out. Fortunately, it's on view for 18 months. The new image for the object record and data system is taken by our imaging services, and that old photograph, don't we all miss printed paper photographs that we have to piece together, go back into that binder. Now we'd like to share a short film with you made by MoMA's Department of Digital Content and Strategy for YouTube, because now a web presence is so very important that along with all the other installation arrangements a registrar must make, we now need to facilitate the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube teams too. But just look at the results.
Oh no.
Oh no.
He broke it.
The results are we're not the ones who know how to work the internet.
Thank you.
It's only 2 minutes.
Yeah, sure.
认识到这个重力和自己关系的一个在。
当这个船插满了剑，它身上都是羽毛的时候，它突然像一只鸟一样可以飞翔起来了。
Thank you. I think that we took up all of our time, so we're really sorry. We ran a little bit long. We may not have time for questions, but you can certainly find us this evening and ask us anything you like. Great afternoon.